Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Teyama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Elizabeth Ando, who already joined us 12 times and shared her truly deep insight into traditional Japanese food culture. And Elizabeth is a food writer and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan for over 50 years. And she runs a culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from Japanese Kitchen, and Kansha, Celebrating Japan's Vegan and Vegetarian Traditions. And today's topic is ice. And it's summertime, and we love refreshing cooling sweets. And in Japan, ice has been an important part of its food culture. And the most famous food would be kakigori, a type of shaved ice dish with unique flavor and texture. And its aesthetics is another reason why kakigori is so popular. And you can go to a specialty shop or Japanese-style cafe to enjoy kakigori, or you can make one at home as various handy tools are available. So today we'll discuss how Japanese people started eating ice 12 centuries ago, and how they developed the elaborate shaped ice called kakigori, the unique flavors and texture of kakigori, and how you can make kakigori at home, and other types of ice used in Japanese food culture, such as hand-carved perfect ice used for cocktails, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So if you haven't, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. By the way, this is Japan Eats' 300th episode, and I cannot believe how far this show has come. So thank you so much for listening, everyone. Now, let's start a conversation with Elizabeth Ando. Hello, Elizabeth. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So listeners who wants to know Elizabeth's fascinating life story about moving to Japan, how she met her lovely Japanese husband, how she started her culinary career, and many other unique experiences, please listen to episode number 18. And also her previous 12 episodes on Japanese are truly fun and informative. So if you are interested in learning from her tremendously valuable and practical knowledge of Japanese food, please go to heritageradionetwork.org and search Elizabeth Ando. It's A-N-D-O-H, Elizabeth Ando. Now, let's dive into today's topic because there's so much to talk about. So, Japanese people are quite obsessed with eating ice. So, when did they start eating ice and what kind of food was it?
Japanese have been eating ice for centuries. The first written record was in something called the Chronicles of Japan, an 8th century document, and it was referred to as an ice room, himuro, and a way of keeping ice naturally cool throughout the year. And they did that by packing it with rice straw, and preventing the heat of the day from melting it. It was obviously only for very important people.
Right. Sounds like it's almost impossible, but they made it happen.
Well, it's interesting. There are stories of the equivalent of ice cellars, these places where ice would be kept and wrapped up, throughout the world at various different times. I don't think Japan is the oldest record. I think the oldest record actually is in the Middle East, in Iran, what's now Iran. But so the idea of trying to keep ice when the weather was no longer cold is not unique to Japan, but I think the way Japanese culinary activity responded to that ability is perhaps different.
Interesting. So we're going to dig into that culinary development. So, yeah, so the kakigori, as I mentioned in the introduction, is the great example of that Japanese culinary pursuit and obsession with ice. So it's a uniquely shaped ice, and we'll talk about the details in a moment. But first, what is the history of kakigori? When and who invented it?
I don't know that there's a person credited for inventing it, but again, the first written record is about 1000 AD. There was a woman, Sei Shonagon, who wrote a rather bawdy collection of poetry, Observations of the Heian Court, and she called this work the Pillow Book, Bakura no Soshi. And in that, there's a reference to crushed ice that's drizzled with a sweet syrup. And clearly, people who know kakigori now consider that the forerunner of kakigori as we know it today.
Right, and I heard that back then that sweet syrup was a natural plant-based called amazura, and it kind of like looks like a honey. So it must be very, very precious thing for to be able to eat.
It was, and my understanding is it's similar to maple syrup in that it's taken, you know, it's slashed, and then the syrup is drained off and boiled down and made into a syrup. It's hard to find real amazura today anywhere in Japan. There are a few places where you can buy it, and I can't say that I've ever really tasted the real thing.
Well, there may be a reason. It may not be as great as what we can taste now, but I love that history. I want to try that one day.
Yeah,
and I also heard that the shaved ice was, of course, needed to be preserved cold. So they served on a metal, chilled metal bowl, which is just by imagining in hot summer, no refrigeration, but no AC, and they managed to cool down, right? So it was a functional food in a way.
Yes, and it was clearly very special. It required great effort to be able to maintain it and serve it. And interestingly, a lot of the culinary history that we have indeed is because the people who ate it were important, and the process for presenting this very precious food to important people was recorded. Otherwise, it would have melted and we never would have known about it.
Yeah, that's true. So, so we very much admire kakigori in modern life, modern days. And so what exactly is kakigori now, and what does it look like, and what is the difference from regular shaved ice in paper cup like you can find in the U.S.?
Well, I think perhaps the biggest difference is the texture, and the Japanese refer to it as hua hua, almost like cotton candy. It's very fluffy, and the reason why the ice becomes so fluffy is really twofold. The water that's used to make the ice and how it's frozen, and also the way in which it's shaved. But the water that is used is sort of ultra-filtered. There's no impurities in it at all. And it's frozen to a temperature of minus 10 C, which is, I think, 14 Fahrenheit. And it's a fairly slow process. So at least 2 days it takes for it to be made. The pure ice, this with no bubbles, no impurities or anything, is referred to as Junpyo. And it's manufactured. It's not natural. There are natural spring water that's used to make ice, but to get that lovely texture that people associate with kakigori, it's actually made from manufactured ice, made in very special circumstances.
Right, so slow, and by slowly freezing ice, I heard the molecules right. in water kind of get right. aligned, and then right. I guess the air comes out slowly, so it's pure and transparent ice, and doesn't melt easily, and that kind of
right.
ice itself is the essence of kakigori, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And then shaving it, and the Japanese are known for their knives, for their cutting blades, and the blades that are even in the less expensive sort of household machines that you can make kakigori with are very well honed, and they're also at an angle where it's really shaved very thin, and the angle and the sharpness of the blade, the combination of the two, is what makes those almost sheets that look almost like tissue paper when you're actually grinding it. And it also makes it easier to eat. It's interesting. There are lots of people who attack a mound of kakigori. Some people do it from the top, others from the bottom, sometimes from the side. what's your method of attack? I always start at the bottom.
Yeah, I do too, because the syrup is underneath, and you can make the most of everything throughout.
If it collapses, it all folds back into the bowl rather than going outside. But I do know people who do it very elegantly from the side and sort of turn the bowl around so that it doesn't get unbalanced in the process. But this foie foie fluffy ice is also easier to eat. I think that regular crushed ice tends to fall out of the cone more easily.
Right. Well, I think you said it's more flatter than actual, like, you know, bowls. That keeps it, I think, kind of expands probably the surface on your tongue, and it releases the cold temperatures as much as, I don't know, syrup. And so, yeah, it's just ice, shaped ice, but it's so much in there. And you mentioned the hua hua. Hua hua is, you know, one of those very unique Japanese adjective. And there's a study, I think it's an academic study in 2003, and someone compared different languages and how many adjectives exist. And in Japanese, there are 455. And in Chinese, 144. And French, 227. English and German, around 100. So sometimes when I have to translate Japanese adjective, like especially this kind of textual or temperature, anything like that, I can't find how I work because there's no equivalent, I guess.
It's hard. As I said, it reminds me, when you look at it, it reminds me of cotton candy. It sort of impossibly holds together. It doesn't look like it should, but it does. And again, when you try to eat it with a spoon, the side of the spoon, it doesn't really collapse. It sort of keeps its shape. And it's probably because in the process of shaving it, it's the equivalent of cutting with the grain rather than against, because it's really almost almost parallel. In other words, the blade is almost parallel to the ice, just barely raised so that it shaves off a very, very thin piece at one time.
Wow. Right. And the visual of how high it is and how dramatically it's presented, that's another thing. But yeah, we'll take a quick break here. And then when we come back, we'll dive into how to make delicious and cooling kakigori at home. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Elizabeth Ando, a food writer and cookbook author and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So so you can go to a shop in Japan, right, to eat kakigori. So how can we find that place? Like, there's a big flag, I think you can find.
There's a big flag with the calligraphy for ice, kori, and it's usually pretty obvious. Also, on hot days, there'll be a long line of people waiting to get in. It's interesting. Ramen shops and kakigori places have very long lines. People are willing to stand in line to eat at the very wonderful places, especially now with SNS and social media outlets where people are announcing where they've just had the best kakigori. Lines form fairly fairly quickly. Most places have the standard or the classic flavors available, things like matcha, and if it has the sweet bean jam as well, it's uji kintoki. And a variety of different fruit flavors. But interestingly, a study was conducted by a market research organization in Japan as to the favorite flavor, and it was strawberry by a large measure. I mean, huge difference between the number one and number two slot, and the number one was strawberry. And the uji kintoki was number three, by the way.
So yeah, there's a strawberry, just strawberry, and then when I grew up, it was like a very chemically colored, flavored pink on ice, and that was my favorite by far too. And my brother liked the melon.
Well, I think also it's the color. Red and white are the colors of felicity, of happiness, and most kids like strawberry. By the way, I've put a recipe up on my website for a fresh strawberry sauce, and nice. It's very simple to make.
We'll discuss later how to make ice at home, but you mentioned uji kintoki, so that's a very, very foundational kakigori flavor, right. And also I think a lot of flavor people think of uji kintoki as the foundation of Japanese sweets. So what is uji kintoki?
Well, the uji stands for the tea. Uji is one of many places in Japan where tea is cultivated and processed and sold. And it's outside of Kyoto, and it's often associated with tea and tea culture. And so the word uji on a menu usually means that it's going to have green tea in there. The kintoki refers to the actual bean. Azuki beans are a kind of red bean, and kintoki is a particular kind of azuki that is especially suitable for making bean jam. And especially the kind where the bits and pieces of the bean are still left in there. In other words, where it's not the smooth bean jam, but rather there are chunks in there. And kintoki mame are probably the best for that. So uji kintoki refers to the two signature ingredients of the dish, the green tea, the matcha, and the sweet bean jam. So in addition to the green tea and the bean jam, there are often what look like marshmallows. They're little sweet rice balls, and they're rather chewy. Some people like them, some people don't. The other flavor that I must admit that I've never really taken to, but it was number two on the survey, was something called renyu, or condensed milk. The Japanese like sweet condensed milk. It's probably my least favorite flavor of them all. Are you a milk fan?
You know, I probably never paid attention because I was so into strawberry and kintoki. So, but I will probably revisit next time I go to Japan. But yeah, it's just a variation, the colorful and different texture of the toppings. And it's just fun. Yeah. And I think the height of kakigori is so exciting because it's almost like impossibly big. You can't have that much ice cream. But if it's shaped kakigori, you can. And you totally cool down after this.
Right. And although, obviously, the sweet syrups have their calories, it's not nearly as caloric as because the kori itself is water. And so it's a relatively low-calorie sweet.
Right. And less cholesterol, I would imagine, than ice cream.
Well, certainly that too, right?
Right. Okay. And so you can go to kakigori shop looking for that famous flag, blue and background and red kori ice letter. And it's actually very, I think I feel like I'm going to frame it and then hang on my wall because it's so dramatic and classic and beautiful. But anyways, but you can make kakigori easily at home with a shaving machine. So what kind of shaving machines are available? Around how much?
There's an abundance of gadgets. I know that when my daughter was little, her machine was one of these that had a teddy bear with eyes that would move when you cranked it.
Yeah.
right. And sort of these googly eyes that would move each time you would hand crank it. Basically, and I guess you can still get those. There was also one, there was a Mickey Mouse one. There was one with children in a bus. But all sorts of sort of kitschy, cute shapes. Nowadays are also these very sort of sleek, sophisticated looking, almost looking like the grinders that grind coffee beans. And you can hold it and hold it over a bowl and create the ice yourself. Many of them are now electric. The old-fashioned ones were, as I said, cranked by hand. To me, cranking it by hand is sort of part of the fun. And there's always a place to put a bowl. But it was definitely a one at a time, and you had to wait your turn. It was a one at a time experience, and if you had friends over, you had to gum on. You had to resist the urge to complain because your friend was shaving her or his ice ahead of yours.
Yeah, and it's in the variation. And then I'm looking at it, for example, it's Amazon website, right. Fiori machine. And they are like a hand cranking machine, like $30. It's fun and you can really have fun with it. And it's a very creative kind of activity with your kids and even adults. It's kind of healing. It's almost like a grinding coffee beans and something like that. So,
are there any of the retro-looking machines? I know in Japan, for a while, it was very popular to get what looked like the original kakigori shaving machine.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at it. It's pretty expensive. It's like $100.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a sort of a flurry of interest in, especially during the pandemic. People were using these old-fashioned looking machines in order to make ice.
Mm. Yeah, during the pandemic, people did a lot of different things. And I think it's not a bad idea. If you don't travel, you save money, so you have money to spend on fancy ice-making machines. And it's pretty cool looking, too. Right. And so you said, you can make own syrup or toppings,
yes.
Right? So. So you gave us an example. It's like a strawberry.
It's a very simple formula, if you will, the equivalent of a simple syrup, sugar and water that's boiled down into a syrup. What's really key, I think, and it's part of my recipe too, is a drop of soy sauce at the end. Adding a bit of salt to all that sweet or a salty flavor to all that sweet actually mellows it so that it doesn't become so cloying, so annoyingly sweet. And a drop of, if you can get it, the light-colored soy sauce so it doesn't change the color of the sauce so much.
Mm, right, that's the shiro shoyu, like white soy.
Shiro shoyu, right. And it's actually saltier than regular, meaning the sodium content is more concentrated in the light-colored soy sauce. So you really only need a drop at the very, very end. But it will make all the difference in mellowing the flavor, particularly for things like strawberry and lemon. Makes a huge difference.
So, I mean, people sweat in the summer. An addition of salty soy sauce a little bit might be very helpful to add some electrolytes in your body, and also it's some umami in there too.
It's definitely the umami fermented flavor as well, but just a little bit of sodium that will counteract all of the sugar. And it's true when you're making any sort of sweet sauce, I think, if you add a pinch of salt at the end, it would make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think what you're saying also is that you can be creative, right? Get any fruits available in farmer's market or supermarket in the summer, you can kind of create your own kind of preserve in Western style. You can top the ice with whatever you create and you can just cool down.
Probably just crushing fresh fruit and adding a little bit of sugar to make it into a syrup, and then again that final drop of soy sauce at the end. I can imagine mango would be wonderful. I can imagine the kiwi might be wonderful. Trying to think what else. Grape is probably possible. I'm not sure that the skins wouldn't get in the way. They might have to be sort of strained out afterwards, but I would imagine almost any fruit would work very well.
Mm, right. And if you can go crazy, then I'll top a scoop of ice cream on top, which I did sometimes, and it's kind
that's
of
also possible.
negate the helpfulness, but yeah, it's why not? It's summertime; you want to cool down. So, right. So kakigori, you can be so creative. But besides kakigori, ice is often found in Japanese cuisine. So, could you give us some examples?
Well, certainly in terms of presentation. And it's interesting, there are gadgets out there now that will enable you to make a bowl out of ice, and then you serve things in that bowl. Certainly sashimi is often served on ice. Somen, noodles, are sometimes served where the bowl itself is actually ice. And the gadget that they sell in order to do that is sort of two metal bowls, and the water that's in between freezes to the shape of a bowl. And when you remove it, you've got your bowl of ice. And if you're not going to use actual ice for your bowl, the Japanese love to use glass in the summertime. It looks like ice, so it sort of feels cool to look at it. And it also makes sort of a tinkling sound when your chopsticks hit the glass. And much like wind chimes, that sort of cooling sensation of hearing the tinkle. All of that sort of gives the impression of being cool on a hot summer's day.
The ice is a great example because seasonality is the essence of Japanese food culture. So ice is just so representative of summer, and many plates made with glasses and blue. And if you go to kaiseki restaurants, which is always a whole gallery of serving vessels that reflects the seasonality, so some of them it's a if you go to Japanese restaurants, it's fun to observe how the serving vessels are expressing this whole mind of seasonality to celebrate it. So,
yes.
Yeah, it's great. And, and especially but Japanese summer is very hot and humid in most part of the country. So,
yes.
Yeah, the, right?
It's already begun. We're in the rainy season here in Tokyo now, and that alternates between days of every day is drizzly, sometimes more than just drizzle, and sometimes really high temperatures, uncomfortably humid, and occasionally a lower temperature, chilly. But we seem to be more in the hot, humid, and probably for the next couple of weeks. So. Thoughts, cooling thoughts and cooling food is uppermost in many people's minds here. It's also interesting, I just thought the month of June is in the old-fashioned lunar calendar, was referred to as Minatsuki, and it's interestingly written with the characters for no water month, but that presumes that it was on the old lunar calendar and it was going to be after the rainy season had stopped. But one of the sweets that served for Minatsuki is a triangle of sweet sort of rice. It's made out of wido, mochigome, and sugar. And it's intended to look like ice, and it's referred to as a himuro, these ice cellars, so that lots of foods and somen served on chunks of ice. So lots of foods that are going to be eaten at this time of year will be themed around ice, even if they don't have ice as part of them.
Interesting. Right. Mm. So that's the, I think that's whenever you go to Japan, and you can always find element of season in on food, on plates, on bowls, and everything. But just going back quickly to himuro, you explained it's a very, very old kind of freezer in a way. But
right.
I went to one of the fancy sushi restaurants, and the chef created himuro for his fish back at his counter because the refrigeration system in the modern system is too harsh on food, the ingredients, delicate fish. So he created actually customer order himuro because it's gentle. And it's almost like a binchodan chako, right? A gentle but intense and not to damage what you're cooking or, so yeah, just protecting with. So, yeah, it's an ancient technology, but himuro is such a cool equipment. I'm so glad people are still trying to use it.
The wisdom of the ancients, clearly at the time, there weren't many other choices. There was not refrigeration as we know it today, but a combination, I think, of imagination and a little bit of desperation combined together to come up with some pretty wonderful ideas. And they're as useful today as they were then. But I imagine it must not be, it must be an ongoing process for him to be able to keep the himuro at the right conditions.
Right. It's like a vinyl, right? For the best sound of music. Wow. And we go back to vinyls. So, yes. Well, so himuro, we'll see how long it can survive. And hopefully it can really, it looks beautiful too in the modern version of the design.
I'm
it's
sure.
the classic, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay. And another famous example of Japanese obsession with ice is hand-carved ice. And top cocktail bars take pride in their hand-carved ice, which is as clear and sparkling as a diamond, seriously. So maybe you can tell us about how special it is.
Again, the ice itself is made from junpyo, from this pure ice, so that there are no impurities in it at all. But I'm always amazed at people, sculpture that can be made from ice. And there are various different contests for ice sculpting, and they're often on display in banquets and other special occasions. And the ability to create ice that will have no impurities is technology, yes, but also determination and careful work, teine, this ability to really focus on carefully doing the work at hand is part of it. The taste of things when that ice is used is also different because it's not adding any chemical flavors. It's not adding any unwanted elements to the ice at all. So you're getting the pure experience as it is.
Right. Not New York City treated water, which actually tastes good, but if it comes to making a cocktail or something, it can interrupt the genuine flavor of the ingredients. And yeah, I think you raise an interesting point, the time to appreciate something. The Japanese cocktail bars are very different. And American cocktail bars are very quick, speedy, creative, fun. But in Japan, you have to really sit down and kind of hush and watch how mixologists make. And ice is, that's why they spend time to hand carve ice as a perfection. I mean, they're representing the perfect art they're creating every day per each glass. So, and then by hand carving ice, perfect round shape doesn't melt too quickly. So you can enjoy the cocktail very slowly and appreciate it, and it's worth waiting for the time it's being made and served. So, yeah, I think it's it sounds crazy that why do you hand carve the ice? But I think there's a huge meaning of it.
I'm sure there is. I must admit, I'm not a cocktail bar person usually, but you have now convinced me I should probably seek out the opportunity. I think it's true of a lot of aspects of Japanese culinary activity. The effort, the care, the consideration that's put into something really has its rewards. It's not just fussy, unnecessary work. It all has a purpose and it has an objective. And when it's done properly, the final product is so much better than it could have been otherwise.
Right.
So and it's true of ice too.
Right. So time slows as the ice melts and life gets more impressive and summer can be more fun as well.
Yes, I think so.
Right. So what are your plans for the summer and beyond?
Staying cool with a lot of ice. not sure that it's going to be much different from what I'm doing now. Japan has sort of reopened, and what I've put up on my website, and anybody who's interested can go there and get details, are small groups who gather on their own, so 1 to 4 people, and then they'll request a particular date, and if I'm available, I will do a program in person. So I've been doing a number of those, and that's probably how I'm going to manage it for the rest of the year, rather than arbitrarily choosing a date and a topic and offering a program.
Okay. Where's the website or anywhere we can go to?
At tasteofculture.com, TASTEOFCULTURE.com, and you'll find lots of resources, a lot of posts that I've done into my kitchen culture blog, also on the projects, which are actually taking those ideas into the kitchen and making something with them. And I have a Facebook group where we do those projects together. And a lot of the archived newsletters, this most recent newsletter was about ice, and there's an archived copy up on my website in the newsletter page. You can take a look at that and then sign up to get future newsletters.
Right. So there's the tap newsletter. And I really enjoy your newsletter because it's very kind of, I don't know, I don't see many newsletters like this, very authentic and very informative. And you really communicate
you.
The essence of Japanese cuisine. So I really admire, I look forward to it every time, you know.
Thank you. I try to choose a topic, and again, it connects to my website where I'm able to use more space to talk more about that topic. And so this time, indeed, the topic was ice.
So very timely.
Indeed.
Okay. So, we'll find another topic for another season, and hopefully you can come back for our 14th episode. So thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. I always learn so much from you. So thank you.
Likewise. Thank you.
All right, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Liam Warner, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.